Chapter 2. Getting to Know the Fuhrer.
The swastika and the Union Jack fly side by side on the Munich airport, and from the moment that Mr. Chamberlain steps onto German soil, we present a complete record of the historic journey of Britain's Prime Minister.
On the evening of August 28, 1938, Neville Chamberlain called his closest advisor over to 10 Downing Street for a late-night strategy session. Chamberlain had been the British Prime Minister a little over a year. He was a former businessman, a practical and plain-spoken man whose interests and experience lay with domestic affairs. But now he faced his first foreign policy crisis. It involved Adolf Hitler, who had been making increasingly bellicose comments about invading the Sudetenland, the German-speaking portion of Czechoslovakia. If Germany invaded Czechoslovakia, it would almost certainly mean a world war, which Chamberlain wanted desperately to avoid. But Hitler had been particularly reclusive in recent months, and Germany's intentions were so opaque that the rest of Europe was growing increasingly nervous. Chamberlain was determined to resolve the impasse. He dubbed his idea, which he put to his advisors that night, Plan Z. It was top secret. Chamberlain would later write that the idea was so unconventional and daring that it rather took his Foreign Secretary Lord Halifax's breath away. Chamberlain wanted to fly to Germany and demand to meet Hitler face to face. One of the odd things about the desperate hours of the late 1930s, as Hitler dragged the world towards war, was how few of the world's leaders really knew the German leader. Hitler was a mystery. Franklin Roosevelt, the American president throughout Hitler's rise, never met him, nor did Joseph Stalin, the Soviet leader. Winston Churchill, Chamberlain's successor, came close while researching a book in Munich in 1932. He and Hitler twice made plans to meet for tea, but on both occasions, Hitler stood him up. The only people in England who spent any real amount of time with Hitler before the war were British aristocrats friendly to the Nazi cause. They would sometimes cross the Channel to pay their respects or join the Führer at parties. In certain moods, he could be very funny, the fascist socialite Diana Mitford wrote in her memoirs. She dined with Hitler frequently in Munich. He did imitations of marvelous drollery. But those were social calls. Chamberlain was trying to avert world war, and it seemed to him that he would benefit from taking the measure of Hitler for himself. Was Hitler someone who could be reasoned with, trusted? Chamberlain wanted to find out. On the morning of September 14th, the British ambassador to Germany sent a telegram to Hitler's foreign minister, Joachim von Ribbentrop. Would Hitler like to meet? Von Ribbentrop replied the same day. Yes. Chamberlain was a masterly politician with a gift for showmanship, and he artfully let the news slip in Parliament. He was going to Germany to see if he could avert war. Across Britain, there was a shout of celebration. Polls showed that 70% of the country thought his trip was a good thing for peace. The newspapers backed him. In Berlin, one foreign correspondent reported that he had been eating in a restaurant when the news broke, and the room had risen as one to toast Chamberlain's health. Chamberlain left London on the morning of September 15th. He'd never flown before, but he remained calm even as the plane flew into heavy weather near Munich.
From the airport, he drives past Heils and Cheers to the station, where a special train waits to carry him up towards the mountains of Berchtesgaden. With the snow-capped peaks in the distance, with the mountain wind swishing past him, Mr. Chamberlain drives up the steep road to the chalet that the German Chancellor has made his home.
Chamberlain arrived at 5 in the evening. Hitler came and shook his hand. Chamberlain would later report every detail of his first impression in a letter to his sister Ida. Halfway down the steps stood the Führer, bareheaded and dressed in a khaki-colored coat of broadcloth, with a red armlet and a swastika on it and the military cross on his breast. Chamberlain wrote, he wore black trousers, such as we wear in the evening, and black patent leather lace-up shoes. His hair is brown, not black, his eyes blue, his expression rather disagreeable especially in repose, and altogether he looks entirely undistinguished. You would never notice him in a crowd and would take him for the house painter he was. Hitler ushered Chamberlain upstairs to his study with only an interpreter in tow. They talked, sometimes heatedly. "I am ready to face a world war," Hitler exclaimed to Chamberlain at one point. Hitler made it plain that he was going to seize the Sudetenland regardless of what the world thought. Chamberlain wanted to know whether that was all Hitler wanted. Hitler said it was. Chamberlain looked at Hitler long and hard and decided he believed him. In the same letter to his sister, Chamberlain wrote that he had heard back from people close to Hitler that the German leader felt he had a conversation with a man. Chamberlain went on, "In short, I had established a certain confidence, which was my aim. And on my side, in spite of the hardness and ruthlessness I thought I saw in his face, I got the impression that here was a man who could be relied upon when he had given his word." Chamberlain flew back to England the next morning. At Heston Airport, he gave a quick speech on the tarmac.
"Yesterday afternoon, I had a long talk with Herr Hitler. It was a frank talk, but it was a friendly one. And I feel satisfied now that each of us fully understands what is in the mind of the other." "I'm going to have another talk with Herr Hitler. Only this time, he has told me that it is his intention to come halfway to meet me."
Chamberlain's negotiations with Hitler are widely regarded as one of the great follies of the Second World War. Chamberlain fell under Hitler's spell. He was outmaneuvered at the bargaining table. He misread Hitler's intentions and failed to warn Hitler that if he reneged on his promises, there would be serious consequences. History has not been kind to Neville Chamberlain. But underneath those criticisms is a puzzle. Chamberlain flew back to Germany two more times. He sat with Hitler for hours. The two men talked, argued, ate together, walked around together. Chamberlain was the only Allied leader of that period to spend any significant time with Hitler. He made careful note of the man's behavior. "Hitler's appearance and manner when I saw him appeared to show that the storm signals were up," Chamberlain told his sister Hilda after another of his visits to Germany. "But then he gave me the double handshake that he reserves for especially friendly demonstrations." Back in London, he told his cabinet that he had seen in the Führer no signs of insanity, but many of excitement. Hitler wasn't crazy. He was rational, determined. He had thought out what he wanted, and he meant to get it, and he would not brook opposition beyond a certain point. Chamberlain was acting on the same assumption that we all follow in our efforts to make sense of strangers. We believe that the information gathered from a personal interaction is uniquely valuable. You would never hire a babysitter for your children without meeting that person first. Companies don't hire employees blind. They call them in and interview them closely, sometimes for hours at a stretch, on more than one occasion. They do what Chamberlain did. They look people in the eye, observe their demeanor and behavior, and draw conclusions. "He gave me the double handshake." Yet all that extra information Chamberlain gathered from his personal interactions with Hitler didn't help him see Hitler more clearly. It did the opposite. Is this because Chamberlain was naive? Perhaps. His experience in foreign affairs was minimal. One of his critics would later compare him to a priest entering a pub for the first time, blind to the difference between a social gathering and a roughhouse. But this pattern isn't confined to Chamberlain. It also afflicted Lord Halifax, who would go on to be Chamberlain's foreign secretary. Halifax was an aristocrat, a superb student at Eton and Oxford. He served as Viceroy of India between the wars, where he negotiated brilliantly with Mahatma Gandhi. He was everything Chamberlain was not: worldly, seasoned, deeply charming, and intellectual. A man of such resolute religiosity that Churchill dubbed him the Holy Fox. Halifax went to Berlin in the fall of 1937 and also met with the German leader at his mountain retreat. He was the only other member of England's ruling circle to have spent time with the Führer. The meeting wasn't some meaningless diplomatic reception. It began with Halifax mistaking Hitler for a footman and almost handing him his coat. And then Hitler was Hitler for 5 hours, sulking, shouting, digressing, denouncing. He talked about how much he hated the press. He talked about the evils of communism. Halifax listened to the performance with what another British diplomat at the time called a mixture of astonishment, repugnance, and compassion. Halifax spent 5 days in Germany. He met with two of Hitler's top ministers, Hermann Göring and Joseph Goebbels. He attended a dinner at the British Embassy where he met a host of senior German politicians and businessmen. When he returned home, Halifax said that it was all to the good making contact with the German leadership, which is hard to dispute. That's what a diplomat is supposed to do. He had gained valuable insights from their face-to-face encounter about Hitler's bullying and volatility. But what was Halifax's ultimate conclusion? That Hitler didn't want to go to war and was open to negotiating a peace. No one ever thought Halifax was naive, yet he was as deluded as Chamberlain later was. The British diplomat who spent the most time with Hitler was the ambassador to Germany, Neville Henderson. He met Hitler repeatedly, went to his rallies. Hitler even had a nickname for Henderson, the man with the carnation, because of the flower the dapper Henderson always wore in his lapel. After attending the infamous Nuremberg rally in early September 1938, Henderson wrote in his dispatch to London that Hitler seemed so abnormal that he may have crossed the borderline into insanity. Henderson wasn't in Hitler's thrall. But did he think Hitler had dishonorable intentions towards Czechoslovakia? No. Hitler, he believed, hates war as much as anyone. Henderson, too, read Hitler all wrong. The blindness of Chamberlain and Halifax and Henderson is not at all like puzzle number one from the previous chapter. That was about the inability of otherwise intelligent and dedicated people to understand when they are being deceived. This is a situation where some people were deceived by Hitler and others were not. And the puzzle is that the group who were deceived are the ones you'd expect not to be, while those who saw the truth are the ones you'd expect would be deceived. Winston Churchill, for example, never believed for a moment that Hitler was anything more than a duplicitous thug. Churchill called Chamberlain's visit the stupidest thing that has ever been done. But Hitler was someone he'd only ever read about. Duff Cooper, one of Chamberlain's cabinet ministers, was equally clear-eyed. He listened with horror to Chamberlain's account of his meeting with Hitler. Later, he would resign from Chamberlain's government in protest. Did Cooper know Hitler? No. Only one person in the upper reaches of the British diplomatic service had both met Hitler and seen the truth of him. That was Anthony Eden, who was the foreign secretary before Lord Halifax. But for everyone else, the people who were right about Hitler were those who knew the least about him personally. The people who were wrong about Hitler were the ones who talked with him for hours. This could all be a coincidence, of course. Perhaps Chamberlain and his cohort, for whatever reason, were determined to see the Hitler they wanted to see, regardless of the evidence of their eyes and ears. Except the same puzzling pattern crops up everywhere. The judge was middle-aged, tall, white-haired, with an accent that put his roots squarely in the borough of Brooklyn. Let's call him Solomon. He had served on the bench in New York State for over a decade. He wasn't imperious or intimidating. He was thoughtful, with a surprisingly gentle manner. This was a Thursday, which in his courtroom was typically a busy day for arraignments. The defendants were all people who had been arrested in the past 24 hours on suspicion of some kind of crime. They'd just spent a sleepless night in a holding cell, and now they were being brought into the courtroom in handcuffs, one by one. They sat on a low bench behind a partition just to Solomon's left. When each case was called, the clerk would hand Solomon a file containing the defendant's rap sheet, and he would start flipping through, bringing himself up to speed. The defendant would stand directly in front of Solomon, with his lawyer on one side and the district attorney on the other. The two lawyers would talk. Solomon would listen. Then he would decide if the defendant would be required to post bail, and if so, how much the bail should be. Does this perfect stranger deserve his freedom? The hardest cases, he said later, involve kids. A 16-year-old will come in charged with some horrible crime, and he would know that if he set bail high enough, the child would end up in a cage in the city's notorious Rikers Island facility where, he put it as delicately as he could, there's basically a riot waiting to happen at every turn. The law, by the way, has since been changed. A defendant must now be 18 years old or above to be sent to Rikers. Those cases got even harder when he looked up into the courtroom and saw the kid's mom sitting in the gallery. "I have a case like this every day," he said. He had taken up meditation. He found that made things easier. Solomon was faced, day in, day out, with a version of the same problem that had faced Neville Chamberlain and the British Diplomatic Service in the fall of 1938. He was asked to assess the character of a stranger. And the criminal justice system assumes, as Chamberlain did, that those kinds of difficult decisions are better made when the judge and those he judges meet face to face. Later that afternoon, for example, Solomon was confronted with an older man with thinning, close-cropped hair. He was wearing blue jeans and a Guayabera shirt and spoke only Spanish. He'd been arrested because of an incident involving the 6-year-old grandson of his girlfriend. The district attorney asked for $100,000 bail. There was no way the man had the resources to raise that amount. If Solomon agreed with the DA, the man in the Guayabera would go straight to jail. On the other hand, the man denied everything. He had two previous criminal offenses, but they were misdemeanors from many years ago. He had a job as a mechanic, which he would lose if he went to jail, and he had an ex-wife and a 15-year-old son whom he was supporting with that income. So Solomon had to think about that 15-year-old relying on his father's paycheck. He also surely knew that 6-year-olds are not the most reliable of witnesses. So there was no way for Solomon to be sure whether this would all turn out to be a massive misunderstanding or part of some sinister pattern. In other words, the decision about whether to let the man in the Guayabera go free or to hold him in jail until trial was impossibly difficult. And to help him make the right call, Solomon did what all of us would do in that situation. He looked the man right in his eyes and tried to get a sense of who he really was. So did that help? Or are judges subject to the same puzzle as Neville Chamberlain? The best answer we have to that question comes from a study conducted by a Harvard economist, three elite computer scientists, and a bail expert from the University of Chicago. For simplicity's sake, I'll refer to the group by one of the computer scientists' name, John Kleinberg. The researchers decided to use New York City as their testing ground. They gathered up the records of more than 550,000 defendants brought before arraignment hearings in New York from 2008 to 2013. Of those, they found that the human judges of New York released just over 400,000. Kleinberg and his team built an artificial intelligence system. They fed it the same information the prosecutors had given judges in those arraignment cases, information such as the defendant's age and criminal record. They told the AI to go through those 550,000 cases and make its own list of 400,000 people to release. It was a bake-off, man versus machine. who made the best decisions? Whose list committed the fewest crimes while out on bail and was most likely to show up for their trial date? The results weren't even close. The people on the computer's list were 25% less likely to commit a crime while awaiting trial than the 400,000 people released by the judges of New York City. 25%! In the bake-off, machine destroyed man. To give you just one sense of the mastery of Kleinberg's machine, it flagged 1% of all defendants as high risk. These are the people the computer thought should never be released prior to trial. According to the machine's calculations, well over half of the people in that high-risk group would commit another crime if let out on bail. When the human judges looked at that same group of bad apples, though, they didn't identify them as dangerous at all. They released 48.5% of them. Many of the defendants flagged by the algorithm as high risk are treated by the judge as if they were low risk, Team Kleinberg concluded in a particularly devastating passage. Performing this exercise suggests that judges are not simply setting a high threshold for detention, but are misranking defendants. The marginal defendants they select to detain are drawn from throughout the entire predicted risk distribution. Translation: the bail decisions of judges are all over the place. I think you'll agree that this is baffling. When judges make their bail decisions, they have access to three sources of information. They have the defendant's record, his age, previous offenses, what happened the last time he was granted bail. They know where he lives. They know where he works. They have the testimony of the district attorney and the defendant's lawyer, whatever information is communicated in the courtroom. And they have the evidence of their own eyes. What is my feeling about this man before me? The computer program, on the other hand, couldn't see the defendant, and it couldn't hear anything that was said in the courtroom. All it had was the defendant's age and rap sheet. It had a fraction of the information available to the judge, and it did a much better job at making bail decisions. In my second book, Blink, I told the story of how orchestras made much smarter recruiting decisions once they had prospective hires auditioned behind a screen. Taking information away from the hiring committee made for better judgments, but that was because the information gleaned from watching someone play is largely irrelevant. If you're judging whether someone is a good violin player, knowing whether that person is big or small, handsome or homely, white or black, isn't going to help. In fact, it will probably only introduce biases that will make your job even harder. But when it comes to a bail decision, the extra information the judge has sounds like it should be really useful. In an earlier case in Solomon's courtroom, a young man in basketball shorts and a gray t-shirt was charged with getting into a fight with someone, then buying a car with the man's stolen credit card. In asking for bail, the district attorney pointed out that he had failed to appear for his court date after two previous arrests. That's a serious red flag. But not all failure to appear cases are identical. What if the defendant was given the wrong date? What if he would lose his job if he took off work that day and decided it wasn't worth it? What if his child was in the hospital? That's what the defendant's lawyer told the judge. Her client had a good excuse. The computer didn't know that, but the judge did. How could that not help? In a similar vein, Solomon said the thing he's most alert to in bail cases is mental illness with an allegation of violence. Those kinds of cases are a judge's worst nightmare. They let someone out on bail, then that person stops taking their medication and goes on to commit some horrible crime. It's shoot a cop, Solomon said. It's drive a car into a minivan, killing a pregnant woman and her husband. It's hurt a child. It's shoving someone in front of a subway train and killing them. It's an awful situation at every angle. No judge would ever want to be the one having made the release decision on that case. Some of the clues to that kind of situation are in the defendant's file. medical records, previous hospitalizations, some mention of the defendant being found not competent. But other clues are only found in a moment. You'll hear terms thrown around the courtroom like EDP, emotionally disturbed person, Solomon said. He'll look at the defendant in those cases, closely, carefully searching, as he put it, for sort of a glassy-eyed look, not being able to make eye contact, and not the adolescent unable to make eye contact because the frontal lobe hasn't developed. I'm talking about the adult off their meds. Kleinberg's machine can't overhear the prosecutor talking about an EDP, and it can't see that telltale, glassy-eyed look. That fact should translate into a big advantage for Solomon and his fellow judges. But for some reason, it doesn't. Puzzle number two. How is it that we can be worse off after meeting a stranger than not meeting them?
The previous night, after the receipt of Herr Hitler's invitation to Munich, he had told the waiting crowds in Downing Street, "It's going to be all right this time."
Neville Chamberlain made his third and final visit to Germany at the end of September 1938, 2 weeks after his first visit.
Now he says,
"When I was a little boy, I used to repeat, if at first you don't succeed, try again."
The meeting was in Munich at the Nazi Party's offices. Italian leader Benito Mussolini and French Prime Minister Edouard Daladier were also invited. The four of them met with their aides in Hitler's private study. On the morning of the second day, Chamberlain asked Hitler if the two of them could meet alone. By this point, Chamberlain felt he had the measure of his adversary. When Hitler said his ambitions were limited to Czechoslovakia, Chamberlain believed that Herr Hitler was telling the truth. It was now just a matter of getting that commitment in writing. Hitler took him to his personal apartment. Chamberlain pulled out a piece of paper on which he had written a simple agreement and asked Hitler whether he would sign it. As the interpreter translated the words into German, Chamberlain wrote, "Hitler frequently ejaculated, 'Ja, ja,' and at the end he said, 'Yes, I will certainly sign it.' 'When shall we do it?' I said, 'Now.' And we went at once to the writing table and put our signatures to the two copies which I had brought with me." That afternoon, Chamberlain flew home to a hero's welcome. A crowd of journalists surged towards him. He took the letter from his breast pocket and waved it to the crowd.
"This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine."
Then he headed to Buckingham Palace to brief the king and then back to the Prime Minister's residence at 10 Downing Street. More crowds awaited him there. He stood on the balcony and declared, "My good friends, this is the second time in our history that there has come back from Germany to Downing Street peace with honor. I believe it is peace for our time. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts." The crowd cheered. "Now I recommend you go home and sleep quietly in your beds." In March 1939, Hitler invaded the rest of Czechoslovakia. It had taken him less than 6 months to break his agreement with Chamberlain. On September 1st, 1939, Hitler invaded Poland, and the world was at war. We have, by this point, heard from CIA officers who cannot make sense of their spies, judges who cannot make sense of their defendants, and prime ministers who cannot make sense of their adversaries. We have people struggling with their first impressions of a stranger. We have people struggling when they have months to understand a stranger. We have people struggling when they meet with someone only once, and people struggling when they return to the stranger again and again. They struggle with assessing a stranger's honesty. They struggle with a stranger's character. They struggle with a stranger's intent. It's a mess. One last thing. Let's play a word game. I'll give you some letters, and you fill in the blanks in order to make it a complete word. Do it quickly, without thinking. G-L space space. This is called a word completion task. Psychologists commonly use it to test things such as memory. I completed G-L space space as G-L-U-M, glum. Remember that. Okay, the next word is space, space, T-E-R. I completed that as H-A-T-E-R, hater. Remember that too. Here's some more words. S, space, space, R-E. A-T-T, space, space, space. B-O, space, space. F-L, space, space, T. S-L, space, T. C-H-E, space, space. Space, R-A, space. Space, 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 E-A-T. I started out with glum and hater and ended up with scare, attack, bore, flout, slit, cheat, trap, and defeat. That's a pretty morbid and melancholy list. But I don't think that says anything about the darkness of my soul. I'm not melancholy. I'm an optimist. I think that the first word, glum, popped into my head, and then I just continued on in that vein. A few years ago, a team of psychologists led by Emily Pronin gave a group of people that same exercise. Pronin had them fill in the blank spaces. Then she asked them the same question. What do you think your choices say about you? For instance, if you completed T-O-U space space as touch, does that suggest that you are a different kind of person than if you completed it as T-O-U-G-H, tough? The respondents took the same position I did. They're just words.
I don't agree with these word stem completions as a measure of my personality,
one of Pronin's subjects wrote, and the others in the group agreed.
These word completions don't seem to reveal much about me at all. Random completions.
Some of the words I wrote seem to be the antithesis of how I view the world. For instance, I hope that I'm not always concerned about being strong, the best, or a winner.
I really don't think there was any relationship. The words are just random.
The words pain, attack, and threat seem similar, but I don't know that they say anything about me.
But then things got interesting. Pronin gave the group other people's words. These were perfect strangers. She asked the same question. What do you think this stranger's choices reveal? And this time, Pronin's panel completely changed their minds.
I get the feeling that whoever did this is pretty vain, but basically a nice guy.
Keep in mind that these are the exact same people who just moments before had denied that the exercise had any meaning at all.
The person seems goal-oriented and thinks about competitive settings.
I have a feeling that the individual in question may be tired very often in his or her life. In addition, I think that he or she might be interested in having close personal interactions with someone of the opposite sex. The person may also enjoy playing games.
The answers go on and on like this, and no one seems even remotely aware that they have been trapped in a contradiction.
I guess there is some relationship. He talks a lot about money and the bank. A lot more correlation here.
He seems to focus on competition and winning. This person could be an athlete or someone who is very competitive.
It seems this individual has a generally positive outlook toward the things he endeavors. Most words, such as winner, score, goal, indicate some sort of competitiveness, which combined with the jargon, indicate that he has some athletic competitive nature.
If this panel had seen my glum, hater, scare, attack, bore, flout, slit, cheat, trap, and defeat, they would have worried for my soul. Pronin calls this phenomenon the illusion of asymmetric insight. She writes, "The conviction that we know others better than they know us, and that we may have insights about them that they lack, but not vice versa, leads us to talk when we would do well to listen, and to be less patient than we ought to when others express the conviction that they are the ones who are being misunderstood or judged unfairly. We think we can easily see into the hearts of others based on the flimsiest of clues. We jump at the chance to judge strangers. We would never do that to ourselves, of course. We are nuanced and complex and enigmatic, but the stranger is easy. If I can convince you of one thing in this book, let it be this. Strangers are not easy.